If you would, open your Bibles to Luke chapter 10. I want to begin with a story and see if we can't figure out who we are in this story. Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 38, we read, "Now they were traveling along, or as they were traveling along, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary, who was seated at the Lord's feet, listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations, and she came up to him and said, 'Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me.' But the Lord answered and said to her, 'Martha, Martha, you're worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her.'" In this narrative, who do you relate to more? Are you a Mary or are you a Martha? Are you interested in sitting at Jesus' feet to listen to him, to learn from him? Or are you more preoccupied with other things? Not bad things, not wicked things, not sinful things, but just other things of life. Martha's was taking care of her guests, a noble thing. She was showing hospitality. Let me ask you some questions. What's more appealing to you? Learning about God or watching an entertaining movie? Studying your Bible or reading a good novel? Participating in a church singing or going to a concert? Listening to a sermon or watching a football game? Be honest. Which of those options are more appealing to you? Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong, on the one hand, to be interested in or even find enjoyment in doing those things like watching a football game or a good movie or reading a good novel or going to a concert. But what I am concerned about is the seeming lack of interest in doing the spiritual things, on the other hand. Learning about God and listening to a sermon and singing praises and studying our Bibles. I've been questioning a lot lately why it is that so many young people, and to be honest, not so young of people, are disinterested in God. Why is it that pursuing God, learning about God, drawing close to God, serving God, you look around the world and it seems that there's only a few people who are really interested in those kinds of pursuits. Why is that? Why is it hard as a teacher of the middle age group class or the middle school slash high school class? Why is it so hard for us to engage the young people in Bible classes? Anybody who's taught these classes knows that sometimes it can be like feel like pulling teeth to get participation in there. We struggle with trying to make a study of God's Word not seem boring, to make it appealing, not monotonous and just the same old thing all the time. And I think that young people are craving for something that is, they feel, relevant to them. And arguably, as a teacher of those age groups, it can be challenging from time to time to find something, a way to engage that doesn't seem boring or that seems more relevant to them. And I think maybe we could make the same observation about the adult class if we're honest. I don't know if I have all the answers to what I think is a complex question, but I'd like to propose to you this morning that at least part of why there are so few who are genuinely interested in pursuing God has to do with a lack of a genuine appreciation for who God is. I mean, if we want people to be interested and pursue God, the natural question is, what is it about God that should warrant my attention? Why is God someone or something that I ought to be trying to pursue and learn about? What's the big deal with God? I'm reminded of an invitation that Jesus offered to those who were listening to his teaching in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 28. He says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And we think, that sounds appealing. I'm worn out, I'm tired, looking for something. He's going to give me rest. He says, "Take my yoke upon you." Now we're kind of like, oh, hold on a second. I got to do some work here? "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me." Jesus says, "For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Though Jesus does a lot of things to make the burden of life lighter for us, when we help to share his yoke, I wonder why so many people don't take him up on this offer. He says, "Come, learn from me. Take my yoke upon you. Be in a relationship with me." Why is it that so few seem to be interested in that? Maybe another way of asking the question is, why is it that so few seek the wisdom and knowledge of God and from God? The wisdom and knowledge from above. I want to spend some time looking in the book of Proverbs today, because I think the book of Proverbs has a lot to say about this question. And I think where we need to start is by acknowledging that first and foremost, if you want to gain wisdom about God and from God, you have to want it. Notice in Proverbs chapter 4 and in verse 7, maybe one of the more odd Proverbs, at least the way it's rendered in the New American Standard. Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 7, "The beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom, and with all your acquiring, get understanding." Say what? The beginning of wisdom is get wisdom. That's always been kind of like a weird way to phrase this. It's always been a proverb that I've kind of stumbled over. What exactly is he getting at? The ESV renders it this way: "The first step to becoming wise is to look for wisdom. So use everything you have to get understanding." The EHV renders it a little bit different, but similar. It says, "The beginning of wisdom is to obtain wisdom. Give up everything you have in order to gain understanding." Those renderings to me express a couple things that I don't quite grasp from the New American Standard Version, at least not naturally. The second thing first is that wisdom is something that is indeed valuable. It's something that we ought to be willing to give up everything in order to gain it and possess it. But the other thing that becomes clear when I look at these translations is the idea that if I want to get wisdom, if I hope to ever obtain wisdom, the first step in that is I have to want it. We look around the world and we see so many naive and foolish people out there. People who lack common sense, we might say. And we wonder, why is that? I made the observation to somebody not too long ago, they call it common sense because everybody used to have it, or it used to be common. There's no such thing as common sense anymore, because most people lack sense. It's not common to have sense. Why is that? I think in a lot of ways it's because there are so many people who have no desire to gain wisdom. There's no desire to gain or acquire knowledge or become more than just simple-minded people. They're content with where they're at. And so I think here the idea of what the proverb writer is saying is that if you want to ever hope to achieve wisdom, to gain wisdom, the first thing you have to do is you've got to want it. You have to be self-motivated. No one can force you to accept wisdom. Yes, as the proverb writer talks about in Proverbs chapter 1, wisdom can stand on a street corner and shout loudly and offer herself to you. "Here I am, come learn from me." But if you don't have any desire to gain wisdom or understanding, you are not going to receive any. And ultimately, when you get yourself in trouble because you did it your own way, wisdom is going to say, "Well, I told you so, or at least I tried to." And now you have to reap the fruit of your own foolishness. If you don't desire to become wise, then it simply won't happen. So the first thing is you've got to desire it. Okay, let's say I do desire it. I want to be wise. I want to gain wisdom from God. Well, where do I begin? Right? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, the beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. Just go get it, right? Where do I start? All throughout the book of Proverbs, we see a phrase repeated that I think gives us a good starting point to pursuing wisdom. In Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7, it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." In Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." And later, Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 33, "The fear of the Lord is the instruction for wisdom, and before honor comes humility." So when I think about where do I begin in seeking this wisdom from God, where does it start? I think it starts with the fear of the Lord. And all throughout the book of Proverbs, we see this phrase, the fear of the Lord, or fear the Lord and something will happen. So for example, we're not going to go through all these passages. I'm going to just put some references up here. But the book of Proverbs makes it clear that to fear the Lord, it is a choice that one has to make. It is something we should desire to try to live in, the fear of the Lord. But again, just like our previous point, you have to want it. Nobody's going to force you to fear the Lord. It's a choice. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 13. The fear of the Lord is contrasted oftentimes with negative things. In Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 16, it's contrasted with turmoil. And the idea of turmoil is something that is in disarray, something that is chaotic, something that's all a mess. The opposite of that is the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord keeps us from evil. It provides, therefore, a strong confidence that we can have. The fear of the Lord goes hand in hand with turning away from evil and walking in the paths of uprightness. The fear of the Lord prolongs life. It is a fountain of life because it helps us to avoid the snares of death. It leads to life, allowing one to sleep satisfied and untouched by evil. That's where that confidence comes from. Okay, you just told me a whole bunch of things that the fear of the Lord does and it can accomplish and the benefits that it will reap. And there's no way you come away from the book of Proverbs and realize that the fear of the Lord, possessing a fear of the Lord, is not somehow vitally important to our growth and to our walk with God. But what exactly is the fear of the Lord? How is fearing the Lord going to help us in pursuing God and wisdom from above? Often times when we talk about the fear of the Lord or fearing God, we frame it in terms of being nothing more than a healthy respect, an awe, an appreciation for God. And I'm not saying that the fear of the Lord does not include those things. Certainly the fear of the Lord will inspire a healthy respect for God. It will cause you to be impressed by God and appreciate what He has done. But is it limited just to those things? You know, today, when you talk to people who are willing to talk about God, it's very popular to think of God in terms of love and peace and mercy and generosity and blessings and favor and benefit. You know, all of the good, positive qualities, we might say, of God. The things that make Him appealing to us. You know, He isn't judgmental. He is forgiving. He's not demanding or exacting. He is merciful. He's not scary. He's lovable. Right? And a lot of people, I'm afraid that what they do in their perception of God is they begin to think of God as nothing more than just a big old lovable teddy bear. I'd like to snuggle up to Him and give Him a hug and, you know, it'd be cozy and comfy, and that's appealing to me, right? Others think of God as nothing more than a dispenser of benefits and blessing. He is the great cosmic vending machine from which when I need something, I can go and I can punch in a few numbers and he will dispense to me whatever it is that I need in that moment. And it's in this context, with this perception of God, I think that we have become more apt to define things like the fear of the Lord in terms that fit the gentler, softer, more lovable side of God. And so we limit the fear of the Lord to nothing more than a healthy, or we might say a deep respect and reverence for God. It's to stand in awe of His greatness. When we look at what God has done, especially what He's done for us, we go, that's pretty good, God. That's pretty awesome. I'm impressed with you. Let me tell you something. That is not what the fear of the Lord entails. Yes, you will have some elements of those things if you fear the Lord. But understand this. If that's all you think about God, you have neutered the power of God. To truly understand and appreciate who God is, how powerful God is, His might and His capabilities and what He can and what He will do, it ought to strike fear into your heart. There is a sense in which you ought to shake a little bit in your boots when you contemplate the mightiness of God. No, Josh. God's not supposed to be scary. God's not supposed to be intimidating. He's love. He's mercy, right? Notice with me a few examples of people who had encounters with God. See how they responded. Look at Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6. Verse 1, the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah says, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of His robe filling the temple. And seraphim stood above Him, having six wings. With two He covered His face, with two He covered His feet, and with two He flew. And one called out to the other and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of Him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. And notice Isaiah's response. Then I said, woe is me, I am ruined, because I'm a man of unclean lips and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. When Isaiah was confronted with God, he didn't go, pretty impressive. He said, woe is me, I am ruined. Daniel had a similar experience. Daniel chapter 10. Daniel sees the Lord in a vision. Verse 5 beginning. He says, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them. Interesting. They can't even see the vision, and yet they're scared. They ran away and hid themselves. So I was left alone, and I saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me. For my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. And I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. Daniel couldn't even stand up in the presence of this vision of the Lord. It's as if all strength left him and he collapses on the ground and falls into a sleep. Similar to John, who sees the glorified, resurrected Christ, I believe, in Revelation chapter 1. Verse 10, he says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like the sound of a trumpet saying, write in a book what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the lampstands, I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to his feet and girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were white, like white wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire. Sound familiar? Similar to what Daniel saw. His feet were like burnished bronze when it's been made to glow in a furnace. His voice was like the sound of many waters. His right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. I think John's saying, when I saw that, it almost scared me to death. That's more than just being impressed with the image or the power or the glory, the might of God. That is to quake with fear. I find it interesting when Saul is on his journey to Damascus to arrest Christians, he encounters the resurrected Lord who appears to him in a bright light. And what happens there? We could look in Acts 9 or his retelling of it in 22 or 26. But in all three instances, he talks about the idea that he was knocked down. He fell down. He's actually blinded by the experience. And it's interesting in all those accounts, he sees this vision, this person, this glorified being in front of him. He doesn't know who it is. He says, "Lord, Lord, who are you?" And Jesus then identifies himself. He didn't know it was Jesus of Nazareth at first, but he knew that whoever he's looking at is Lord, Adonai, God. And he's knocked on his butt. Similar to Moses' experience in the burning bush, you remember Exodus chapter 3? Moses is shepherding the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, and he's out there in the wilderness, and he sees this bush off in the distance that's on fire, and yet that bush just keeps burning. It's not burning up. What's going on with that? Moses says, "I've got to figure this out." And so he walks over to it, and the Lord speaks to him from the bush. Notice Moses' response. Exodus chapter 3. The Lord called out to him from the bush, "Moses, Moses," verse 4, and he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said to me, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now it's interesting, several years later, Moses will actually ask God, "Can I see you in your glory?" And God says, "No, I'll pass before you. I'll cover you in the cleft of the rock. I'll pass before you. And as I'm going away, I'll let you see the back of my glory. But nobody can see me and live," he says. And that's something that's interesting. All these other guys we talked about who were, you know, almost quite literally scared to death at this appearance of the Lord, they weren't even seeing the full glory of God. No one can see the full glory of God in this human form and live. That's how impressive, that's how powerful, that's how mighty, that's how scary, I dare say, God actually is. When God appeared to Israel at Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 19 and 20, turn over there just a few pages in your Bibles. And notice how he appears to them in a very powerful, magnificent, forceful way. And notice what he does when he's there, and notice how the people respond. Start with me in Exodus chapter 19 and in verse 16. "So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound." And notice how the people responded. All the people who were in the camp trembled. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace. The whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. The Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down, warn the people so that they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them." And Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, 'Set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it.'" And the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, and do not let the priests and the people break through to come to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them." And notice verse 25. So Moses went down to the people and told them. I point out verse 25 because Moses has now gone up the mountain and come back down, and he's with the people. And notice chapter 20 and verse 1. "Then God spoke all these words, saying." You know, sometimes when we retell the story of the Ten Commandments, we view it as Moses going up on the mountain, having a conversation with God, God telling Moses what the Ten Commandments are, writing them on the tablets of stone, and then Moses coming down the mountain and relaying the message to the people. But that's not what happened the first time. That'll happen the second time. But the first time that the Israelites heard the Ten Commandments, they heard it from the mouth of God. God spoke these commandments down the mountain to them. And just jump down in the text to verse 18 and notice the people's response. "All the people perceived the thunder and the lightning, the flashes, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and they stood at a distance. And they said to Moses," verse 19, "'Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but let not God speak to us or we will die.'" Moses, this is too much for us. If God says another word to us, we're going to die. Like, these people were scared. And I think rightly so. Because they saw the manifestation of God's power on Mount Sinai. They heard the voice of God speaking directly to them. And it was too much for them. But notice what Moses says to the people to comfort them in verse 20. He says, "Do not be afraid. For God came in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin." It's interesting, Moses kind of says, don't be afraid, God did this so that you would be afraid. I think what he's saying is, don't be afraid that you're actually going to die by listening to God. He's not actually going to kill you. I know it's scary. I know it's impressive. I know it's powerful. I know it's intimidating. God showed himself to you this way so that you would have that fear. Not so that you would constantly walk around quaking and trembling, but so that you would have a healthy fear and respect for what God can do. And that fear will motivate you to refrain from sinning. Now, what's interesting to me is that though we don't live under the same covenant that God came down and gave the Israelites there at Sinai, Jeremiah prophesies about the new covenant under which we're going to live. And just notice how he describes it. Because I think God has the same intent and purpose, at least in regarding us, his people, having the fear of the Lord in ourselves. Notice in Jeremiah chapter 32 and in verse 40, God says, "I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good." And notice this, he said, "I will put the fear of me in their hearts." Why? So that they will not turn away from me. God still wants us to be afraid of him. Under this new covenant, he said he will put the fear of himself in our hearts. Why? So that we will be motivated to remain true to him. And it's this fear of the Lord, this genuine respect and appreciation of the power, the might, the awesomeness of God, that in a sense will and ought to make us quake a little bit. That is what the proverb writer says is the beginning of knowledge and wisdom. I'm afraid that so many people have no interest in pursuing God because we have made God to be something that is not very impressive. We have diminished the power and the might and the majesty of God. He's nothing more than a teddy bear or a vending machine. No, He is the creator of the heavens and the earth. He is the one and only judge and lawmaker. He is the one who has the power to save and the power to condemn. And when you think about that, if you really understand that and appreciate those facts about God, that ought to make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. It ought to make you fear Him. Maybe this is a poor analogy, but I'm going to try it anyway. When I was a kid growing up, my dad was not an abusive man. He'd spank me if I deserved it. And let me tell you, when he spanked, I felt it. I'd much rather get a spanking from Mom than Dad any day of the week. I knew that if my dad wanted to, he could hurt me. And I'll tell you what, it was that knowledge sometimes, especially as I got into my teenage years, it was that knowledge that, man, I know if I push the envelope too hard, if Dad wanted to, he could hurt me. So I better back it off a little bit. I think in some ways that's the attitude we're supposed to have towards God. And that ought to motivate us to seek Him, to want to do what's pleasing to Him, to understand His will, to pursue Him. Because ultimately, He's the one who's in control, not we ourselves. And yet, I wonder if there are so many who are disinterested and disengaged from God. There are so many who don't pursue wisdom. They don't even want wisdom from God today. They don't see value in God's ways. I wonder, could it be because we as His people even have forgotten how to fear the Lord? You know, it's interesting to me, a sure sign of foolishness is the inability, or at least the unwillingness, to see and acknowledge the obvious truth that's right in front of your eyes. Psalm chapter 14 and verse 1, the psalmist writes, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Just as we were talking in class this morning, though, Romans chapter 1, we can look around at creation. Even if we've never read His Word, we can look around at the creation and we can see His invisible attributes, His eternal power. So that the only people who look at creation, the thing that's obviously before their eyes screaming, there is a God, and can say, God doesn't exist, are the people that Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 1. That though they knew God, they did not see fit to honor God. They willfully turned a blind eye to Him and ignored Him. It's interesting to me that the psalmist says that the person who denies the very existence of God, that is the epitome of foolishness. And yet, the Proverbs paint the picture that to fear the Lord, to really understand who He is and what He has done and what He can and will do, that is where wisdom begins. You cannot be truly wise while ignoring God. Maybe that's why there's so many stupid people in our world today. Because there's too many people who don't want to acknowledge God and give Him the glory and honor that He deserves. Now, maybe we aren't totally ignoring God like the outright fool. But I wonder if we, in our own practice, in our own conduct, in our own attitude towards God, have diminished God so much in our mind that He is small and insignificant. And certainly nothing, no one to be scared of. We become so desensitized toward the power and the awesomeness of God. And I'm all for preaching about grace and mercy and love. Those things are important. But not at the expense of righteousness and justice and obedience. And maybe that's at least part of the reason why so few seek the wisdom that comes from God, why so few seek Him. It's because we don't spend enough time talking about just how powerful God is. We don't live our lives with a real fear of the Lord. Maybe that's one of the reasons why so many young people today who grow up in the church, graduate and go off to college, go off into the world, and we never hear from them again. Maybe it's because we weren't living in the fear of the Lord and showing them what that's all about. And they've grown up wondering, what's the big deal? Why is this even important? So what I want to do is I want to end this lesson by reading to you Psalm 104. There are a lot of passages of Scripture that talk about the power, the majesty, the justice of God. But I want to read Psalm 104. It's a little bit lengthy. But I hope that as I read it, you will be impressed as you contemplate God's greatness. And may that cause all of us to shake in our boots a little bit and fear Him more every day. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, You are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering Yourself with light as with a cloak, stretching out heaven like a tent curtain. He lays the beams of His upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds His chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind. He makes the winds His messengers, flaming fire His ministers. He establishes the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains, yet at Your rebuke they fled. At the sound of Your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which You established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth. He sends forth springs in the valleys. They flow between the mountains. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Besides them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They lift up their voices among the branches. He waters the mountains with His upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of His works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the labor of man, so that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine which makes a man's heart glad, so that he may make his face glisten with oil and food which sustains man's heart. The trees of the Lord drink their fill, the cedars of Lebanon which He planted, where the birds build their nests, and the stork whose home is the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The cliffs are a refuge for the Shephanim. He made the moon for the seasons. The sun knows the place of its setting. You appoint darkness, and it becomes night, in which all the beasts of the forest prowl about. The young lion roars after their prey and seek their food from God. When the sun rises, they withdraw and lie down in their dens. Man goes forth to his work and his labor until evening. O Lord, how many are Your works? In wisdom You have made them all. The earth is full of Your possessions. There is the sea, great and broad, in which are swarms without number, animals both small and great. There the ships move along, and Leviathan, which You have formed to sport in it. They all wait for You, to give them their food in due season. You give to them, they gather it up. You open Your hand, they are satisfied with good. You hide Your face, they are dismayed. You take away their spirit, they expire and return to their dust. You send forth Your spirit, they are created, and You renew the face of the ground. Let the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord be glad in His works. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. Let my meditation be pleasing to Him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord. Let the sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord.